Satipano Bhagavato Savaka Sangho Uccipatipano Bhagavato Savaka Sangho Yaya Patipano Bhagavato Savaka Sangho ขาธิปันโนปะคะวะโตสาวะคะสังโฆยะทิฏังจัตถาริภุริสายุคานิอัตถภุริสภุคะลาเอสะปะคะวะโตสาวะคะสังโฆอะหิเมโยภะหิเมโยสักขิเมโยอัญจะลิขะระณิโยอนุตตรังปุญญะเขตังโลกัสสะธัมมังสังฆังอภิปุจจยามิธัมมังสังฆังสิรสานังThis is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech.Humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied, not busy with duties and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm and wise and skillful, not proud and demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove, wishing in gladness and in safety. May all beings be happy.Whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away,Those born and to be born, may all beings be happy. Let none deceive another, or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another.Even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings, radiating kindness over the entire worldSpreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outwards and unbounded, free from hatred and ill will, whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsinessOne should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding, by not holding to false views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being freed from all sense desires, is now born again into this world. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu.
Oh, oh. Okay.
So, we have some questions. Excellent. And as you would have seen, just outside the offices, there is a lectern, and on top of that lectern there is the sheets for the interviews. But please remember, the interviews are supposed to be about meditation, not about family life or your kid or whatever. Because I have never been married. I have got no children. So, what would I know? Just because you don't know, it doesn't mean you can't give an opinion. But try and keep it sort of brief, because tomorrow, that usually I do go over to Bodhinyana Monastery for the lunch there, so I have to leave at 10:20. So I have to keep to the schedule. And also, because tomorrow, for those of you who don't know, it is the full moon day. Ooh. So because of that, we had to do a ceremony over in Bodhinyana Monastery, and that's at, we have to be over there by 4:30. So the last two interviews tomorrow, I have to cut them off. So we finish the interviews at 4:10 tomorrow. So in any way, you know, sometimes when people ask individual questions, it's very incredibly rare that I haven't heard that question before. And sometimes they come up and say, and the person interviews, can you please answer this question about walking meditation? The next one, they said, oh, can you answer this question on walking meditation? The next one says, can you answer this question on walking meditation? They put it on a piece of paper. It's much easier. It's more efficient. And everyone can share the answers. Anyway, this is a good one to start off with. In the realm of non-linear or spherical time, what happens to hungry ghost energy? Hungry ghost energy? So it's a science question. In this world, there is negative and positive energy, and I don't mean just emotional energy. I mean stuff. Because you have things like, often mentioned, it's like potential energy. If you remember that at high school physics, this will take a lot of energy to throw into outer space. If I had the energy, I might do it. But, so I can have an early night. But, so this has a negative mass energy component. And because there's so much matter in gravitational fields, electromagnetic fields, that always has a negative mass energy component. So I remember I like to throw things up in the air. This is, but metaphorically speaking. And so when I was doing a conference? There was some presentation together in University of WA with Professor David Blair. You know, he was the head of physics at UWA. And that when we were, and I said, well, what happens? What would happen if the total amount of mass energy is positive and the total amount of negative mass energy, if it all came together, would it balance out? So this universe, as far as stuff is concerned, is zero sum. And he looked at me and said, wow, you are really up to date. Ajahn Brahm, yes, omega equals one. Because they always give it a name, they always give it some symbol somewhere. So the physics, even though you don't know what it means, just they say, omega equals one, it perfectly balances. So if you took all of the planets, the suns, the asteroids, the dust, the dark matter, the life, you bring it all together, squash it all up, come together, it wouldn't explode, it would all balance out, poof, and go to nothing. How cool is that? So, how many of you watch The Life of Brian? A few people my age, yeah. And what did he say? I won't say everything he said because he said some rude words at the end. We come from nothing, we go to nothing. That's all there is. We're not talking about human beings. We're talking about sort of stuff. Zero sum. So anyway, hungry ghost energy, all energy balances out. That is why it can go to cessation. Nothing gained, nothing lost. How cool is that? What has changed most about your practice in the last 5 years? How are you this evening? What's changed most? How do I know that? Because you live in the present moment. So how are you this evening? That is such a very, very deep question, because what happened to me recently was because I was getting on in years, and somebody mentioned to me that you can get a Commonwealth Seniors card. So I apparently get it at 60, but I'm 67. I said, why not? So it's an interesting experience. So I called up. I think I had to call up Centercare. So I actually went online. But said, that's not good enough. You have to go and prove who you are. I was sort of identity fraud. So I had to go up to the Centrelink in Armidale. And I was waiting in line there. And he said, what ID have you got? You have to prove who you are. And I paused and told this poor lady, this clerk, I said, prove who I am. I've been trying to answer that question for the last 44 years, ever since I became a monk. There's no one here. And I said, Anatta, no self, nothing here. I said, yes, but... Have you got a driving license? I said, no, I haven't got a driving license. Have you got a credit card? No, I haven't got my credit card. Have you got a bank account? I haven't got a bank account. Have you got a marriage license? No, I haven't got a marriage license. Certainly haven't got that one. And all the things which you usually have as idea, have you got your rental agreement or your rates agreement for your house? I said, no, I haven't got anything for that. I'm a monk. And he said, well, you must have something. I've got a passport. I said, that's not enough, having a passport. But fortunately, I've got two passports because I'm a dual citizen. So apparently that counted just. So actually I discovered something very profound when I went there to apply for a senior's card, that I actually exist. Because I've got two passports. But yeah. So how am I this evening? I am like this. Hey, Ann, come on. This is just the same ones. Same paper, the same handwriting. How is your meditation going? My meditation's going nowhere. What does nowhere mean? It's a combination of the two words now and here. So my meditation is going now and it's here. Can't get better than that. So it's going nowhere. It's here. Anyway, we're all very fortunate to be able to attend this retreat. Ha ha ha, you don't judge yet. You don't know what's going to happen next. Could you please inform us of the current status of the proposed Buddhist monastery in Albany? Is this Buddha's writing?
Yeah.
Now, it's getting there. Where it's getting, I don't know. But anyway, one day it's going to get there. So maybe ask at the end of the retreat, maybe have some more information. I listened to a talk of yours about Buddhism and homosexuality. In it you said that Dalai Lama would soon be coming to Australia and then you intended to share with him how his comments about gays and lesbians could be hurtful. That was years ago, a long time ago. Were you able to have this discussion with him, and was there a positive outcome? They look like they're old pieces of paper. This was probably a question written a long time ago, and it's just somebody found them and just had to put them in this one today. They look like this like old paper, brown. But anyway, no, that was just, it was an article which came from the Daily Telegraph in London. That was years ago. Almost 20 years ago, I imagine now. So this, and it just because the Dalai Lama said it, you can't be a Buddhist and a homosexual at the same time. And he asked him about it afterwards. That was what he reported, but he said no. So anyway, that times have changed, and that unfortunately, that there was one time, the last time the Dalai Lama was in Perth, was it the last time? I think I was away the last time, but one of those times, it was just so hard to even get close to him. Security. And sometimes I thought, wow, just doesn't really matter. But I was really a little bit sort of disappointed. There was a couple of Tibetan nuns. You know, they followed him. You know, that was his teacher. And even the security can't get close. And Dalai Lama was trying to sort of break through his own security, but they wouldn't let him, unfortunately. So anyway, the times have changed, and so certainly there's no problem in homosexuality. Okay, was it LGBTQI plus? The whole range, that there's no problem with them embracing everything about Buddhism. To the point that it is, you know, some of you may have a friend, a brother, a family member who is one of not so gender specific as, you know, you may have grown up with, and there's no problem there at all. Buddhism is about compassion and respect. And quite frankly, there's as many LGBTQIA plus members of our Buddhist society, and they're very welcome, and they have a great contribution to our Buddhist community. And I'd rather have a person who is LGBTQIA, same-sex marriages, whatever, that's not a point. What is important is that they're good people. You judge a person by their actions, by their goodness. There's nothing in the precepts at all about sort of forbidding or just criticizing or stigmatizing LGBTQIA plus. We're also just, you know, stigmatizing people's sexuality or sexual preferences. But what I was really surprised at sometimes, the reading sort of articles, they said, oh yeah, we can accept LGBTQIA plus. Did I miss out one? Yeah, I think I've got most of them. But it said, the one thing which I think was unnatural and could be cured is celibacy. So celibacy is unnatural, they said. I thought, oh, come on. So now I want to see if I can, without offending anybody, to have LGBTQIAC for celibates. Because it's your choice. You don't have to sort of have sexuality. And you can live a wonderful life, with or without. So anyway, so that's how you don't stigmatize a person. You don't, because you can understand how it must feel. You know, if you're somebody who's, this is who you are, and you're not going to get sort of change this. And even to try and change it, you don't try and cure anything. You care for it. Care for people. You know, if you could actually, I don't know if any of you were an outsider at school or something because you were somehow different. Either, you know, that you were didn't look the same as other people from a different race, different religion, or, you know, something about you which made you different. And that really is very, very hard to take. And it's wonderful when people are totally accepted. One of the The great education experiences which I had was, again, working, just this was my volunteer work when I was a student. And I cherish this, that's why I speak a lot about it. This was in 1969, 70, 70, 71. No, it's actually 70, 71, 72. Was volunteering in the institutes. Well, I don't know why people put this institutes for Down syndrome people. They just put them away in institutes. And just, they were stigmatized. But they were just such fun to be with. I know you've worked with so-called disability people. That's even that word, disabilities. Quite frankly, their emotional intelligence was far, far greater than these Nobel laureates and famous physicists which I met over in Cambridge. Preferred their company, frankly, because they were kind and they were just, emotional intelligence was great. Fortunately, we don't institutionalize so many people these days. Difference is accepted and put inside our community, and they add to the great fabric of our societies. So anyway, yeah, that's my views. I'm very strong on that. There's no problem at all. And if you somehow hate them or have problems with them or get offended, you know, by those people who are different, and that's not very Buddhist. We open the door of our heart to anybody else, caring for them, no matter who you are, no matter what you've done. That's the way forward in life. Anyway, when meditation is not going perfectly, he's reading books on meditation, such as the Mindfulness Buddhism Beyond, permissible? Of course it's permissible. We haven't got CCTV cameras in this retreat center. You don't have to go behind or go into your toilet and close the windows to be able to read a book. Because sometimes you wonder, why do people have to be afraid? Is it permissible, not permissible? Now you have precepts and it's up to you. You to find out your middle way in this retreat. What you can do, what you can't do, how much you can do. And if you push too hard, you'll find again you just get really tense and negative. You'll never get into some meditation, to any sort of peaceful meditation. Kindness, compassion, happiness is an important part of meditation. So if you want to read a book on meditation, fine. There's a little library we've got there now. But don't spend all the time reading. What Ajahn Chah used to say, you know, he said the books and the practice is like the main course of a meal and the sweets. So, if all you ever do is read books, it's just like eating sweets. And you get sick. You know, sometimes you see that at the Nolamara Center on a weekend. You see, after we do all these ceremonies and then say, now you guys can eat. And all the parents, they go to the front of the table to get the rice or the potatoes and the curries, but their kids, they don't wait in line, they just go to the other end and get the sweets before their mother can catch them. Anyway, so reading books is like having the sweets, but if you do the practice, and it's like having the main course as well. So it's okay to have a few sweets, but just make sure the main course is eaten first. Very good. Is there guided meditation throughout the day? If so, what times, please? Usually at 1 o'clock in the morning, no, it's only the only time we do the guided meditation is usually sometimes do a guided meditation as part of the 8 o'clock to 9 o'clock talks. But if you really need those guided meditations, in order to stop you wandering off here and there, is you can download them. You know, everybody has these devices. That's why they have them out now, just recording talks and stuff. You can put them on your, what they call tablets or iPhones or whatever. Anyway, put them on their iPods. And then you can listen to them while you're meditating. As long as it's guided meditation and not sort of the news or not the, what else is there, the football. Or, because I like telling anecdotes. When I was about 14-year-old, we started getting, this is so old, okay, technology, transistor radios. And they were, you know, this big. And you could have like a little earphone. And we worked out in school, you know, you had your jackets on, and so you could actually hide it in an inner pocket and have the sort of the lead to your to the earphones in your hand. And you were listening to the teacher as he was giving a Latin class. But you were listening to the test match, the cricket. And the kids, they're always so stupid that, you know, sometimes you think they got really into the cricket and then they're watching the teacher at the same time and then suddenly, wicket, wicket! Oops. And they get busted every time. But anyway, that was just when I was a kid messing around doing stuff like that. But if you are listening to some guided meditation, it can be very helpful at first, especially for the first few days. But I know sometimes people ask, well, can we have more guided meditation? But then that disturbs other people who like to sit quietly. So it's hard to please everybody. So the solution is to get those guided meditations. You download them on your little machine there. And it's okay if I see you just, you are sitting there with your little earphones in and just getting very peaceful. Well done. What is the difference between the self, the mind, and the consciousness? And what is the purpose of seeing through the illusion of the self? Because the self causes you so many problems. From the self we got our needs. It separates us from other people. It keeps on saying, I'm not good enough. Hands up if you're not good enough. Hands up if you're too good. And that, if you're no good. What a waste of time all that is. I don't know, as Bianca told you about the two lines for the buffet, the meal in the morning?
Yes.
Yeah, the two lines, yeah. Because they have the self-service is for those who are still deluded. The no-self service. It's for those who are enlightened. It's only a joke, okay? Self-service and no self-service. So, what is the difference between the self, the mind, and the consciousness? The mind, especially the will, and the mind consciousness, the knowing, is what people assume the self is. You are under the impression that you're the one who decided to write this. That you have your own free will decided to come to this retreat. It seems that way, but is it really the case? How much control have you really got? And this is scary stuff. And the will? Years and years ago, okay, the driverless bus simile, it's one of my favorites. Yeah, trying to explain these things in a way that everyone could understand. And this was a long time before Google cars with their self-drive cars, automatic cars. No. So I imagine that life is a journey. That's not pretty common, that's not new. Life is a journey. And in a bus, and you're sitting in your seat in the bus, and on your journey, it happens you go through this really beautiful, scenic, landscapes, mountains and beautiful waterfalls and green fields. And, oh, just everything looks so scenic and lovely. And you ask the driver of your bus, slow down, even let's park here so I can enjoy this amazing scenery. And more often than not, what does your bus driver do? Puts his foot hard on the accelerator and speeds out. The happy, wonderful times of life don't last that long. Well, they should. Why not? Why do we always have to spoil the nice times by speeding out of here? And then other times of life, your bus is going through the nuclear waste dumps of life. The toxic, desecrated battlefields where there's nothing is beautiful at all. And so what do? You ask your bus driver, get out of here quick. And what does your bus driver do? Slams on the brake and parks. I think you understand the simile. Why is it the happy times of life, they go so fast? And when you're sick and tired and going through divorces and depressed and it just goes on and on and on. It really gets slowed down. So that's why one of the reasons why people come to religion or spirituality or yoga or meditation is to try and teach this bus driver a lesson, how to drive their car or their bus, so you can slow down and enjoy the happy moments of life. And the difficulties of life, they don't last so long. You can have skillful means to get out of the difficulties of life, sickness or arguments or problems, so you don't have to just suffer unnecessarily long because of a stupid bus driver. So you decide to teach your bus driver a lesson. Kindness and wisdom and skillful means. So how your bus driver doesn't get into trouble and can enjoy the journey, and you can enjoy your journey much better. So what happens? First of all, you've got to find where that bus driver is. Find the bus driver's seat and the controls of your body and mind. So in the simile of a bus, eventually you get out of your seat where you usually sit and observe life and go to where it's all controlled, the bus driver's seat, deep inside your mind. And finally, after all of that meditation and wisdom and stuff, you finally find the bus driver's seat. And you see the bus driver's seat and you get a shock because there's no one there. It's empty. No self, no driver. Automatic process. Just like Google Car. And that is a shock you never expected, especially 20, 30 years ago. I should have patented that. You know, you could have made a lot of money for all these monasteries and trying to support. But we don't patent things. So the driverless, what happens then when you find there's no one there? Nothing else to do. You sit and you go back to your seat and you stop complaining. You start, I want to get out of here. Craving. I hate this place. Ill will. There's no one to complain to. So you sit down and shut up. No more suffering. So anyway, that is the driverless bus simile. Have you ever felt stuck in spiritual materialism? For instance, desire to attain enlightenment, high stages of jhana. Don't monks and nuns have such desire when they become one? Of course we do. When I became a monk, my goal, my aim was to, especially when I came to Australia, was to be the hermit of the Nullarbor. Because in the Nullarbor plain between Perth and Adelaide, there were many caves underground, and I love caves because they're quiet, they're peaceful, they're cool, don't need air conditioners in caves. And there's plenty of water down there. The only thing you needed was just You know, some food every now and again, but if you didn't go far away from a roadhouse, you could just go there and just have a bit of food, that's all you need, and meditate there. And I started fantasizing about being the hermit of the Nullarbor, left alone, peaceful, just to meditate and just have some deep, deep, deep. But then I started to think, what would happen next? Soon, somebody would find you. And I thought, wow, how long have you been down here? And I said, oh, maybe 3 or 4 years. And I said, wow. And then the word would get out, and then somebody would go and write an article about you, because it's newsworthy. Why did you leave the world and go deep in a cave in the Nullarbor? Was it a failed love in your life? Did you lose all your money? Or what made you leave the world like this? And then I'd say, no, just I love being peaceful, being by myself. And that'd be really weird. And so they'd publish that, and then the TV crew would come next. And the TV crew, they would air it, very popular, The Hermit of the Nullarbor, Why You Left the World. And then afterwards, then more visitors would come. And of course, when you have lots of visitors, you'd actually have to have, like, toilets, because the local council will say, no, you have to have proper facilities here. And then, of course, you'd have a place, a nice road, so that buses could come in and park. And then you'd also have many tourists coming, lots of Japanese tourists or Indonesian tourists with their cameras, click, click, click. And they have a little gift shop afterwards on the outside, you know, with little certificates. I visited the Hermit of the Nullarbor, and little dolls, you know, to put in there, little fat doll of the Hermit of the Nullarbor. All started out because you wanted some peace and quiet. So I realized, like, come on, you can't escape. So instead of spiritual materialism, what's the opposite of materialism? It's sharing and kindness and generosity and peace, which is the opposite of materialism. But then you've got meditations. And, you know, you've heard me talking later on about jhanas and these incredible states of mind, the bliss better than sex and all that sort of stuff. And as soon as I say that, wow, yeah, I'm into this, come on, tell me how to do this. But what happens, the same thing which happened to me, because when I was a lay person, got a very deep meditation, it really blew my mind away. You know, that was only a metaphor. Really amazing. And then you started to, it blew my girlfriend away, that was for sure. And then afterwards, you know, you tried for quite a few years trying to get back. Because obviously it was just an amazing state of mind. I see this happen to so many people. They have a really good meditation and then striving, trying to get back to those states of bliss. And it took a long time. Of course, you know, you read, you know, the teachings of the Buddha, you listen to great masters like Ajahn Chah, but it doesn't matter what they say, you know, sometimes you just don't understand. It doesn't get in. This is one of the reasons why. This is not a joke, this is really quite deep. Why I tell the same stories again and again and again. Why I answer the same questions again and again and again. It's because that if you really saw the answer, then you wouldn't need to sort of ask the questions. Sometimes it takes a long time. You see a little bit of the answer, a little bit more, because this is what happened with Ajahn Chah. And when he taught me, and I look back now, how could I have missed that? He was telling me so directly, so beautifully, but every time I kept missing it, until, you know, basically ready for, you know, for the mind to be opened. But in this particular case, it was quite clear. Instead of wanting the results, the bliss, look for the causes. Why did that happen? And I just give you so many clues that first 3 or 4 lay people who got these jhanas, it's actually the first 2 I think, then I gave up asking them, could have been 3, And I asked them, first one, he said, well, you know, confirm, yeah, what you did was a really deep meditation. I said, well, what did you do special this time? What did you do this meditation which you hadn't done before? What were the causes? Was it the case that you were, you know, had a nice meal, or you're sitting on the right cushions, or the temperature was good for you? He said, no, no. He said, what I really did this time I hadn't done before was really let go. That's what they said, really let go. And the second person, they said exact word for word the same, really let go, they said. And the third person, maybe not exactly the same words, but, you know, just about the same, really let go. That's the key. So now you know what to do. Doesn't help, does it, really? But eventually it does. You try this, you try that. That's why I said this morning, just learn how to let go, little by little. And after a while, you just totally let go. And you bliss out. So letting go of trying to get bliss, of course, you know, that's the spiritual materialism, wanting something. And of course they get so stuck in those things, spiritual materialism. But, you know, it's a lot of suffering. How we should keep our hands when we do walking meditation, thank you. Keep them on the end of your arms. Sometimes on evening talks you do smart ass answers. Well, it doesn't really matter. You can put them here, you can put them there, you can whatever. So wherever they feel comfortable. You can, if you've been in the military before, you can do marching. I won't do that today, Venerable Nuns, but one day we'll have to show the kangaroo walking meditation, but not today. Dear Arjuna, the jhana grove is delightful, the night is starry, birds are awesome, and heavenly scents are floating in the air. Isn't that romantic? What kind of retreatant illuminate this jhana grove? Just a modern version of the Gosinga Sala tree would, yeah. That's one of the suttas. Very wonderful sutta. What kind of retreatant illuminates this jhana grove? Every one of you does. All in your own different ways. That's actually pretty much the Buddha's answers. All the different types of monks at that time who were there. So it's all of you illuminate it. It doesn't matter what stage you are in the path, where you know your life is going, the fact that you're here. And some of you here come from very long distances, both physically and spiritually. Some of you have very difficult lives and past lives, you're here. Well done, sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. The fact you're here illuminates this place. So sometimes I tell a person that when you sit down, that's enough. You got here, you're keeping precepts as best you can, you're sitting down here listening to Dhamma. Wow, isn't that an amazing achievement you got this far? Everything else is just bonus. Sometimes you sit here, I'm just here, this is good enough. I don't want anything more. A few days of peace. When you don't want anything more, that's when you get the jackpot. Okay, I don't want anything more. Don't want anything more. I don't want anything more. Come on, jackpot. Come on, bliss. I don't want anything more. Really, really, come on. Jhana, please, come on. I don't want anything more. How long do I have to do this for, not wanting anything more and really letting go? I've been really letting go for such a long time. Nothing's happening. You can understand what's going on there. What is the best way for someone to verify the existence of past lives for themselves? And can a normal lay person do it? Meditate, do this? Of course. You know my past life? My past life was Peter Betts as a young layman in England. That's my name before I became a monk. Okay, so not what you really meant by a past life. So if you really want to verify the existence of past life for themselves, if one of the easiest ways is actually to do this hypnotic regression. You've got to find someone you trust. It's much easier to get regressed these days. But there's always a little bit of doubt there. if you do it through hypnotic regression. And one of the reasons is that because, you know, the hindrances haven't been totally overcome. But nevertheless, you get some interesting information. And if you get a decent sort of a regression therapist who knows how to ask the questions, but not forcing you. It has to be like no leading questions. And then information comes out, you can go and check it afterwards. See if it's true or not. And that's the really interesting stuff. When people are like, no, I just has made this up, this is a fantasy. When you actually find the details are true, ooh, that is weird. And there's one other way, the spontaneous recollection of past lives. When you go to a place or a situation which is, you know, where you were in a past life, and it all starts flooding back to you. And one of the most amazing cases of that, which I recall, often quote, you can find it over in the internet, was of this English comedian called Roy Hudd, H-U-D-D. And, you know, people of my age who watched the TV in England in those days, you know, he was what they call a household name. He never made it into movies, he never made it into United States, but he was well known in UK. And his story was that he was doing some gig in a theatre in London at a time when the London Council had changed the streets into a one-way system. And him and many other people got totally lost. Their normal route home was blocked. And so he got lost in the streets of London. And, you know, he went down a street he'd never been to before, and he said he was driving his car, and just the old goosebumps all over, because he could remember the street from his previous life. And as soon as it maybe happened in like a city like London, simply because the facades are the same. You know, they've got heritage in this very old city, and so some of the streets, some of the buildings look exactly the same. Inside they're redeveloped, but outside they're the same. And so it came flooding back to him, his previous life. And he knew the house where he lived before, and you know, he knocked on the door of the house, and of course they recognized him. He wasn't sort of that strange. They knew him on TV. "Roy Hudd, what are you doing here?" He said, "I used to live here." "No way, we've been living in this house for 30, 40 years. Oh, much earlier than that. And it was one of those houses which did have a blue plaque on the outside. If you know London, anyone who is reasonably well known, they have these little blue plaques on the outside. And he was maybe you don't, I don't know why I know this, but as soon as you mention the name, a fellow called Dan Leno, D-A-N-L-E-N-O, who is a very well-known music hall, probably the most famous music hall entertainer in the 1910s, 20s, maybe 30s. And he was so well-known that they put a little plaque here. That's where he used to live before. And that's when this gentleman, Roy Hudd, said, "That was me." He remembered so much about his life. And it cost him dearly, because he was contracted to one of the main TV channels. I don't know if it was BBC or ITV in UK in those days. And the head of that organization was a very devout Christian, a Catholic. And as soon as this Roy Hudd wrote an article about his experience, he was blacklisted. Could hardly work again. And that was the end of his career. But, you know, he's willing to actually to put that on the line. And he actually wrote books about the life of Dan Leno. He became the academic expert, because he was Dan Leno before. He knew all about him. So that was an amazing little, but even that sometimes gets you into trouble. But it was actually very clear memory, knew exactly what he was. That's the spontaneous, triggered by some occurrence in this life. But the way we do it in meditation, it is developed at least a deep enough meditation on the edge of jhanas, or you come out of jhanas. And then you just, you know, you can recollect your past lives pretty easy just by asking the question, what's my earliest memory? And the difference between that is it's because the hindrances, the five hindrances, which we'll hear about later on, especially the fifth one, doubt, is totally gone. So when you have that memory, there's no doubt at all that was who you are. In the same way that when you go to your room after this talk, you know that's your room. You look in the mirror, oh yeah, that's me. That type of very clear, no doubt at all memory. And that was one of the striking features and the differences of past life memories through meditation. It's clear, no doubt at all. That's who you were in the past. But just because I started mentioning that, if you do play around with your past life memories through meditation, some people, some of the students, they have got past life memories, but they tell me just, you know, they just say, please don't teach people to do that anymore, because the memory they got was the previous death experience. The strongest experience and the closest to this life is often your death in your previous life. And as you all know, that death is not the most pleasant moment of your existence, and sometimes it can be very painful and very traumatic. And so when you get the past life memory through meditation, you're reliving it. You're back there. You can feel things and smell things and know things. So that's why they told me, look, that was so traumatic for me, please don't ask people to do that anymore. And I admitted my mistake, that I should have asked people, instructed them to, if you do get a past life memory through meditation and it's unhappy, painful, all you need to say is, earlier please. It's pretty much, now I know these things because you see these on your computer, press the rewind button. So it goes forward, don't sort of have to wait there, just rewind and go to earlier in your life, when you're early in your past life. So that's the only sort of warning to give you, and just a way to overcome that warning. So it really depends just on how, whether you want to know your past lives, whether you're interested in that, whether you have deep enough meditation to do it, just a very clear way, or what happens. It's all very interesting because there's so many people say, it's just imagination, it's not real. And sometimes that doesn't matter how much information, research, how many times you go trying to refute these things and you find out they're irrefutable, this actually happened, information couldn't have been got any other way. Still, if it doesn't fit your worldview, you will refute it and say it can't be happening. That's why, I always like telling stories with my mate Bernard Carr. Professor Bernard Carr, Emeritus Professor of Theoretical Physics at Queen Mary College in London, close associate, more close than I thought, of Stephen Hawking's. But he's also was a treasurer, the last I heard, of the London Psychic Research Society. We go in, doing really cool things like investigating ghosts and stuff. And I know one cool thing we did. We actually had this table, and we were supposed to try and go to sleep and see if our soul left by seeing if the weight of the body got less when you fell asleep and when you woke up again, whether the weight increased. Trying to weigh the measure the weight of the soul if you astral traveled or something. It was totally useless, a wasted experiment. Good fun though. On the high-tech equipment and stuff. But anyway, that, later on sort of, got much more refined in the experiments. And he told me, he had one of his friends and visiting one of these psychics, where the tables were levitating all over the place. And, he said, well, it happened. But he said his mate, who was a research scientist, he was just there to check out anything was weird happening. So he went under the table, he checked it for all sorts, had all sorts of devices, and he could not find any reason or cause whatsoever that this table was levitating. No, heavy table. And eventually he turned around to Bernard, and this is what Bernard told me. He said, this isn't happening, I'm hallucinating, I'm imagining this. In other words, he was just refusing to admit what was happening before his eyes, because it just didn't fit with his worldview. And he said, that was amazing, that's one of the problems there with even past lives. If you tell other people, they will say, it's rubbish, you're hallucinating, you're mad, you've got to go and see a psychologist or psychiatrist, okay? That's why that sometimes it's best to keep these things personal. And also, if even you sometimes have doubts. But it explains so much. I began meditating after watching a serial movie about Lord Buddha 1.5 years ago. The more I watched in the movie, the more curious I got about meditation. Since then, I have started to meditate, and I have read your books and got guidance and found that meditation was doing strange things to my mind. This something precipitated me to learn more about Lord Buddha. This mind of mine has been experiencing some amazing and awesome things. Great. And I would very much like to have the opportunity to speak with you, please. My knowledge I have of Buddhism is very little, but I feel I have only just taken a first step on the noble path. I look forward to speaking with you. Thank you. Yes, you man, I like awesome, weird stuff. Because weird stuff, the only reason why it's weird, because it challenges us to see things in a different way. There can never be anything as weird as some of those experiments I saw in the Cavendish laboratory, creating lasers, just spitting atoms, and all this other weird stuff, quantum theory, all that stuff, that was so weird and strange, but it was true. And weirdness, to me, was just another window to expand your understanding of this universe and truth and reality. It wasn't something I was scared of, but we realized that this was something which was stretching my understanding of the world. And that's what science, that's what the world, you might even say it's one of the great meanings of life, to challenge and find out deeper truths. Thank you for allowing us to join this retreat. I'm forever thankful that my mum has introduced your Worm book from Indonesia, and I've been your fan ever since. The Worm book is, you know that story of I've got to say it now, haven't I? The two monks. There were two monks who were best of friends, and they always hang out together in their monastery and monastic life, and when they died, one of them went to this wonderful heaven realm and was enjoying himself there, and the other one, because of some bad karma, monks and nuns sometimes, bad karma, I don't know why, but anyway, the friend got reborn as a worm in a pile of hot, stinky cow poo. And he was very happy in the cow poo, because that's nice and warm, and that's, just fragrant, from a world's point of view, and it's also food. I love that sort of stuff. Imagine your favorite food, especially this time of night when you can't eat anything. I don't know what your favorite food might be, whether it's like rice and curry, or hoppers, or what else has it got? I don't know. Whatever your favorite food is. And imagine you are right in the middle of it as a worm. You could eat as much as you like whenever you wanted. It was all, it would never run out, and it's fragrant. And, oh, yeah, this is great. So that was like the worm. But the friend up in heaven thought, oh, where's my mate? We were such good friends together. Where they got reborn? I can't find him in heaven realm. So decided to use their powers to check out all the different levels of heaven. Couldn't find his friend anyways. Ah, yes, obviously, he must have been reborn as a human being in the human realm, because the human realm is one of the best realms to progress on the path to enlightenment. So he searched everywhere in the human realm, couldn't find his mate anywhere. Ah, you know, maybe he was reborn as one of the big animals. And looked in the elephants and the monkeys and couldn't find him anywhere. Maybe the small animals, couldn't find him there. Maybe the creepy crawlies, and oh my goodness, there is my mate. He's been reborn as a worm in a pile of cow poo. Now, what would you do if your friend was in trouble? Would you just leave him to his pile of shit? Of course you don't. You always go and help friends. So the heavenly being manifested in all its fragrance and splendor in front of this stinking, steaming pile of cow poo. Just doing that. Imagine, say, Her Majesty the Queen of England coming and appearing without her corgis in front of a pile of cow poo and saying, and this is that heavenly being, much higher than the Queen of England, and saying to the worm, hey worm, come out. And the worm poked his silver head out of the cow poo and said, what do you want? I said, we were best of friends in our previous life. Oh, you were a worm too. No, we were mugs before. And I have been reborn in this beautiful heaven realm. It is so peaceful and fragrant, and the food is... Food is delicious up there, said the worm. He said, oh yes, said the heavenly being, really delicious. What, you have cow poo in heaven? Oh no, not cow poo. We don't eat cow... Well, no cow poo, I'm not going, said the worm. So, no matter how the heavenly being described heaven, because it didn't have cow poo, the worm wasn't going to go. So forget it, go away. But that never stopped the heavenly being. The heavenly being decided to try extreme measures. He grabbed the worm and tried to pull it out of its pile of dung. But you know worms, especially when they don't want to go, they wriggle and writhe, and because they're covered with the slimy cow poo, they're very slippery. And the worm was wriggling and writhing and wriggling, I don't want to go, leave me alone, I'm being wormed now, leave me alone. Not kidnapped. And so escaped. I went right into the middle of the pile of dung. That didn't stop the heavenly being. He put his fingers inside the poo. Now what sacrifice that will be. I mean, not just, you know, the Queen of England, but who is ever, you know, you wouldn't find even Donald Trump doing that. Who else is? But friendship meant sacrifice. So went right inside there, found the worm, tried to pull it out again. Leave me alone, go away, I don't want to go. And the worm went right inside again. And in that book, because that was the last story of the 108 stories in the book, there's a nice way to end that book. And I said, 108 times the heavenly being tried to pull the little worm out of its pile of shit. And in the end, the heavenly being had to let go and go back to heaven alone and leave the worm to its pile of shit. And people got the message. 108 stories I've been trying to get people out of this. Did they want to go? No. I like my tongue. It's fragrant, it's warm, it's comfortable. Do you want to leave your part of town? Become monks and nuns? No, not yet, maybe later. So that was the Indonesian Buddhists. You know, they loved that story. And so I became known there as Guru Chaching. Chaching means worm. And guru obviously means, you know, the teacher of the worms. So whenever I go back to Indonesia, they say, oh, our teacher is back. And all your little worms are very happy to see you. It's just very good fun, good joy. So anyway, that's called the Worm Book. I'm grateful the Buddhist Society of WA uploads your talks so that I can hear them as I live in New South Wales. Being here for a live talk is definitely much more entertaining than in video. It will be an unforgettable experience for me. As for meditation questions, how do I stay focused, mindful and happy all the time like you? I don't stay focused, mindful and happy all the time like me. You put pressure on me now to be mindful and happy. No, sometimes I go to sleep. So anyway, in other words, don't try and be like anybody else. Oh, actually, to be mindful and happy all the time like you, first of all, you've got to eat more and put on weight. Do you really want to be like me? Or how about being happy in your own life? In other words, care for yourself and your mind. And don't try and cure things. But it's interesting, one point there, which was the live talks and the video talks. Because sometimes I mention this to, you know, people who just spend all their time SMSing people, their friends, and even their friend is sitting right next to them. So, you know, you SMS a message and you take it and you SMS back. I said, well, why can't you talk together? So it's the same. It's not the same. If it really was the same, Skype calls or SMSs, then what you would find is you wouldn't need to sort of, you know, come all the way from so many different countries for a meditation retreat. You can put it online. You wouldn't need to sort of queue up for hours to see a concert from one of these celebrity entertainers. You wouldn't need to sort of go to a big auditorium to see a football match. You just watch it on TV. But there's a live experience is very different than seeing something on a screen, which is one of the reasons why talking with one another is much better than messaging. And that's how kids can understand. You're actually being there. The experience is far more complete. Any recommended reading during the retreat or after the retreat? I'm fairly new. Yes, just read the schedule, read the instructions, read the menu. Does actually Bianca give a menu? Today's meal is this. Read your mind. No recommended reading, but if you do get bored, I said that we have a library out there, haven't we?
I think it's been taken away.
Taken away. Okay. Banned. Well, you can always read the chanting book if you're desperate. Sometimes it's nice to read nature. Go for a walk. Just open your senses. Feel take your socks off and feel the ground underneath your feet. Feel what it's like. Feel the heat on your head, but not too much, otherwise you get sunburnt. When you have food, just feel the food as it's in your mouth. Really sense it. Spend more time in the present moment. And you're reading, or rather you're listening to life, rather than being told what it is. Is hearing otapa the same as feeling guilty? Not really, because feeling guilty, that is something which is counterproductive. If you feel guilty about something, guilt usually has punishment attached to it. And when that's what happens in a court of law. Kanchana, guilty. Now, what am I going to punish you with? I sentence you to... Now, that's because of guilt and punishment usually go together. This is one of the reasons why people just deny guilt. Or they don't accept it because they're afraid of its consequences. Which means a lot of time it gets hidden and buried deep in one's consciousness. It's much better if we don't have any guilt, we use our mistakes to learn from. Hiriotapa, is trying to prevent you doing things wrong. Guilt is what happens after you've made a mistake. And instead of just understanding that you're imperfect beings, and that we do make mistakes, and the job when we have made a mistake is not to hide it out of guilt or shame or a because of big egos. Instead, we admit we've made mistakes, and as a result, that we learn from them. There's no shame in making mistakes. And Ajahn, the 37 facts of enlightenment, what are we supposed to do with these? Develop and practice these? There's so many of them. How many do you really, really need to become enlightened? There's a lot of repetition there as well. So what to do with these? First of all, the best of those 37 factors of enlightenment are the Eightfold Path. So keep it simple, just Eightfold Path. Then you've got Satipatthana, the Four Right Efforts, the Five Powers, the Five Indriyas, Controlling Faculties, there's the Seven Enlightenment Factors, and there's also the Eightfold Path. The Eightfold Path is the best. It is one of the reasons why, just keep it simple and develop the Eightfold Path. The other ones will come with it. I tried walking meditation first time today, and I found that focusing on each step and all the muscles was very pleasant. Yay! Less thoughts popped in my mind than sitting meditation, less pain, stiffness. Yay! I wonder if we can reach the nimitta with walking meditation, as we can't completely close our eyes while walking. Yeah, you can just pretty much get to the nimitta stage, but if you get that close to nimitta stage while you're walking, please return to your seat and sit down to make the most of it. Because sometimes I'd always thought you can't get past nimitta stage, or when you're doing walking meditation. But one of the monks in Thailand said, yes, you can, because he saw evidence of that. There was a monk who would do walking meditation and get into the jhanas when he was walking, and he knew that was happening because he had so many cuts and bruises on his face. Because once you get into jhana, you've got no awareness of your physical senses, so you don't know where you're walking. If you got into walking and you got into a jhana here, you may end up in the middle of the forest somewhere. If you kept on going, you'd end up in Sydney. Because that's what happens when you get into a jhana, you don't know where you're going, because your mind is deep inside, your focus. Anyway, what are you wondering about that for? People always like to think when they're doing. Sorry, this isn't directly about meditation, so it impacts it. Ajahn, moving from a situation of trust and love to an uncertain one with good strangers fills me with more than normal fear. I have a good idea of the causes that have shaped the skewed response, but it comes up overwhelmingly and distorts my perceptions of people, places, and situations, as well as causing me much suffering. Thank you. So, it's a trust and love to an uncertain one with good strangers. So whenever there's any fear, I like the simile of the child who learns how to swim. So imagine a little kid who's took him so many years to learn how to feel safe on dry land, and you can walk without sort of falling over. And then mummy takes you to a swimming pool for the first time. You can see so many people having lots of fun in the swimming pool, but imagine you're a little kid. You don't know what this water is. You only just learn how to walk on dry land. So what does mummy? Mummy doesn't throw the kid in, which is screaming. You just put a foot in and take it out again. When the mother is right next to you, put it in, take it out again. Oh, that feels okay. Put 2 feet in. Mother's right there, you can take it out whenever you want. Oh, that feels okay. Put the whole leg in. Take it out again, make sure you feel okay. And then mum can sort of drop you half your body in. That feels nice. Take it out again. So you don't feel that you're rushing, going through your fears. And then afterwards, mother drops you fully in, and then can't get you out of the pool again because you're having too much fun. You're enjoying it. You go at your own pace, you know, past fear, until you realize that most people in this world have got wonderful kindness in them. And strangers, this is what, even I remember, I think it was Ajahn Sumedho years ago when he first went to England. And he said, well, what if people don't feed us? How will we survive? And then Ajahn Chah replied, aren't there kind people in Europe? Yeah, there are kind people. He said, then you'll get by fine. Don't have to be Buddhist people. Kind people. You know, give people half a chance, and they'd always choose kindness over anything else. So there's a lot of kind people in this world, so you don't need to fear. And you got the creme de la creme in this place. These are some of the highest minded people in the whole world. So it's a pretty safe place here. And that's one of the reasons why whenever you pass one another, you can always smile. Just a tiny act of kindness makes people feel welcome. Ajahn Brahm, are monks and nuns available? Huh? For what? Sorry, I'm just available and allowed to answer questions on meditation practice during the retreat. Or should said questions be saved for interviews? Yeah, save them for interviews or put them in the box. That is the best. I like to ask about fear. How to get rid of fear? I am terrified to talk in front of a crowd. In a situation like that, I lose my mind. That's what you're supposed to do. Lose your mind. Lose your body, lose all your 5 senses and your 6 senses. Lose all of your craving, lose all of your possessions, material or spiritual. Be a loser. Have you read The Art of Disappearing? One of its other books. And in there I was saying the whole point of this Buddhism is to lose your past, your future, all your attachments, all your fears, lose everything. Be the greatest loser. The biggest loser. We can't become the biggest loser, because who was the biggest loser? The Lord Buddha. So when people come up to me in the street and said, you loser, ah, sadhu, 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 you must be a Buddhist, you recognize what we're up to. Not gainers or winners. Did you ever notice, I used to play football when I was a kid, if we ever won a game, especially in the tournament, you had to play another game afterwards. If I pass an exam, there's always another exam afterwards. Until I realized, hey, you know, if I want to relax and enjoy myself, why not lose? When I lose, then I don't have to play again. I can relax and enjoy. If you fail an exam, you don't have to take any more. Yay, I'm out of it. So be a loser. They're really cool. So anyway, you lose your mind. In other words, what happens is you don't know what you're supposed to say. Forget all the words and can't understand what's happening to myself. My mind goes blank. Fear, is it something that I can get rid of by meditation, mindfulness? Absolutely. So what actually happens after a while is you have fun, joy. Because you can't have fun, joy, at the same time as fear. So I decided years ago when I started becoming popular as a teacher, I'm going to enjoy myself. If you enjoy it or not, I don't know. But I enjoy it. That's why I enjoy telling all my jokes. If you've heard them again, they're really nice jokes. I like hearing them again. So because of that, that's one of the reasons why. One of favourite jokes. This is not an old one, it's quite a new one. The one about the fellow who fell off the cliff. He fell off the cliff and he managed, just as he was falling off the cliff, to grab something, a tree root or something, coming out of the cliff face, stopped his fall, and he looked up. It's impossible to climb up to the top. And he looked down, such a long way down, certain death. And so he looked up and started shouting out, "Help, help!" And no one answered. He shouted loudly, "Help, help!" He said, "Please help me!" And then the clouds parted, and a booming voice came up from heaven. "I can help you, but you have to have faith in me." "I have faith, I have faith." "You never went to church, so you've got to prove your..." I was a bit too busy, but now I'll have faith. He said, "You prove it. Let go of the branch." And he looked down, a long way down, and he looked up and shouted out, "Anyone else up there?" Okay, anyway, here, what does it do? What was that one? This one here somewhere. Oh, how to get rid of fear. So when you have fun, enjoy, it takes away all the fear. So before you actually, it's like sometimes people, they play tennis matches with their friends, and then they enjoy themselves. But then they go and sort of do an examination, and then they get tense up. What's the difference? It's all competition, but one is just, "Oh, this is important." The other one is just having fun. So this is where I have fun. Get to say all my bad jokes. So try and put in fun in what you're doing when you're talking. And then it's really easy. Find a little joke or something, and then sort of, it's great when you can't remember the punchline. What was that? Oh, okay, this is... Yeah, come on. Here we go. It was the school formal, the prom, the school dance. So the guy, he had his girlfriend, invited her, because they had to go and get the tickets. And it was a long line, of other kids, other members of the school, trying to get the tickets for the school prom. But he waited in line, eventually got the tickets, and then he had to go and get, a proper suit, a tuxedo. And so when he went to the shop, again, a long line of other students waiting to hire a tuxedo. But he waited in line, eventually got the tuxedo, very patient guy. And then he had to go and hire the limo. And so he waited in another long line by the limo hire firm. Such a long queue. But eventually he got the hired the limo. Then he had to get flowers for the evening. Another long line of other students waiting for the flowers. And then he invited his girlfriend, his partner for the night, and there was a long line of other students waiting to be checked as they went into the venue. And then he asked his girlfriend for the night. He said, "What would you like to drink?" She said, "I'd like to have some of that punch." And there was no punchline. Some of you got it. There's a line for everything else, but no punchline.
Oh, crikey, it's a waste of time, isn't it?
You see, I'm not afraid of failure when I tell jokes. Anyway, we go. What does a Dharma teach about dreams, their significance or the insignificance? Sometimes during sleeping meditation, I have intense dreams, which I think may be recollections of a past life. Usually not of a past life. You get those during the waking. But anyway, who knows? Maybe you might find something there. But usually most of the dreams have no significance. What should you do if something very sad, a loved one's death, keeps coming up at points when you're meditating? Please, it means it hasn't been dealt with. Let it come in. Please allow it to be. Otherwise, it's trying to teach you something and you haven't learned the lesson. You always have to repeat lessons if you haven't sort of understood them yet. But when you really feel safe and peaceful and open, then these things can come up and they're nowhere near as bad. There was this, as you imagine, there was this lady over in Dianella I was counselling once, so she was dying, and many years ago. And there was something, she was obviously hiding something which was bothering her. So one day, it was actually in the office at Dhammaloka, I asked her, I said, "What's the worst thing you've ever done in your life?" She said, "Oh, I can't tell you that." I said, "Come on, look, you're going to die soon, and I'm a monk, and so you can let me know." It took a long time to get it out of her. What she'd done, she said, she'd been married happily for many years with kids. She was a grandma, and she said, "Once when I was young, I kissed another woman's husband." "Is that all?" Yeah, well, it's terrible. "If that's all you've done in your married life, that's not bad. It's not good, but I mean, it's, you know, it's just..." But for her, and when she actually confessed it, she realized too that the more she hid this, the more bigger and more ashamed and more guilty it got for her. And it was, you know, it's, you don't recommend that, but it was still, you know, not sort of nowhere near in the extreme bad karma states. So, anyway, this is one of the reasons why when you allow these experiences in and you really let them teach you, you find you didn't really have that much to fear anyway. We seem to have some unidentified guests on retreat, namely the very cute teddy bears. Perhaps they deserve an introduction. When we do a loving kindness or bear meditation or bear awareness, then we'll introduce them. But you're quite welcome to take one of them and look after it, because some of them feel just so alone, so rejected and unloved. So if ever you've had the feeling of being rejected and unloved and no one cares for you, they just look at you, then you can take a teddy bear and I'll tell you what to do with them afterwards. What do you and all Buddhists think about psychedelic drugs, specifically for the purpose of expanding consciousness and dissolving the ego? Think more danger, more damage than any success. So don't really, I mean, the Buddha was very wise. The Buddha was actually saying no sort of mind-altering drugs. Thank you for your inspiring and playful teachings. My question is about skillful renunciation of sensual desire. I'm going through this quite fast because we're already going over time. Oh, just one more question after this one. I have worked with repressing sensual desire of one type, but it appears in my dreams and I get this sense of frustration. How do you go about moderating sensory desires skillfully? A lot of sensory desires come about because there's no other way you can find contentment. It's a reaction to suffering and disappointment, sensory desires. So what usually happens when you get peaceful in meditation and you get some strength of mind and happiness. Sensory desires, just they can't compete, you know, with the pleasure of the mind, of the sixth sense. So after a while, you know, these things just, when I was many years ago, I've been here about 36 years, I think, now, in Perth, almost, on Waysack. But anyway, that's one of the first years I was here, that Ajahn Jacquo asked me to go and give a talk at Mercedes School, you know, in Victoria Square, you know, just opposite the Catholic Cathedral there. It was a girls' school, and it was a girl of about 14 or 15 year old girls. And if you know teenagers, sometimes they can be very cheeky. So one of them, when I was questioned, I talk about Buddhism, and then about being a monk, and then one of the girls put their hand up, said, "Yes, what's your question?" And she said, "Do girls still turn you on?" And that's what she said. "The girls turn you on then?" And another girl came to her, "Oh, don't listen to her, she's always cheeky like this, she always embarrasses us." And I saw the same girls a few days later when I was in town somewhere, and they came up to me and they said, I said, "Oh, you gave a talk at our school a couple of days ago." "Oh, yeah, you remember me. Sorry, we'll never forget you." "Oh, isn't that cute? They never forget me. Why won't you forget me?" "We'll never forget a monk named Ajahn Bra." There's an M on the end. You know, the girls are cheeky. So anyway... So, a lot of times, the sensory desire, it only comes up if you're tired, lack of contentment, exhausted. It's just an escape when there's no other thing to fulfill you. Last question. "I'm asking on behalf of a friend who heard half a joke of yours and wants to know the rest." Now, if you ask on behalf of a friend, in the Buddhist way, they have to come themselves. Patatan weditabo winyuhi. To be experienced, each one by themselves. Isn't that personal understanding, not word of mouth? So whoever they are, they have to come up and ask it. Oh, crikey. That's such a bad... Oh, actually... Surprising, people didn't understand that, because I said that was the one at Armadale the other night. Was it? Anyway, the joke about the monk who opens the door and gets punched by a cockroach. Okay, here we go. If you want to know the origin of this, is one of Nibbuto's jokes, isn't it? I think it was, okay. Anyway, that he said that this gentleman answered the door one evening and there was a 6-foot cockroach standing upright at the door. Without any warning, the cockroach punched this guy in the nose and then scurried away like cockroaches do. And he thought, "What did he do that for?" And his wife said, "What's up, darling?" And imagine telling your wife you were punched by a 6-foot cockroach. You know, she would think you were mad, crazy. So he said, "Oh, nothing, darling." And so he just denied it ever happened. And the next day, the doorbell went, and he went to answer again. 6-foot cockroach was back there. But this time, the cockroach never punched him. He just took off and headbutted him. He fell on the floor with a broken nose. But he said, "What could he do? Can't go and see the doctor. I mean, if you confess, what happened to you? I got headbutted by a 6-foot cockroach. You know, they'd really..." And anyway, the next night, the 6-foot cockroach was back, but this time, the cockroach had a knife and it stabbed him. And it scurried away. Of course, You can't hide that. He had to go to hospital and had to do a report. So he told the doctor, you know, he said, well, you might not believe this. You might think I'm crazy, but this actually happened. You know, the first night, this 6-foot cockroach punched me in the nose. The second time, he headbutted me. And this a couple of hours ago, he stabbed me. I'm not crazy. It happened. Please believe me. And the doctor said, I believe you. You know, it's not the first time this has happened. Because there's a very bad bug, nasty bug going around. Well, actually, more people actually got it this time. A nasty bug. Cockroaches is a bug, like a virus or like the flu. We say there's a nasty flu going around. It's a nasty bug going, oh, crikey. Okay, one of his other jokes, which is much easier. Why is the body like a prison? Often said, our body like the prison of the body, you feel just stuck in here, especially when you get old and sick. Why is a body like a prison? Because it's made up of cells.
Okay, I think that's time for me to ring the bell. Okay. Sadhu. Okay. No he's tonight. Must have been very bad jokes. Okay. So now, please have a nice night's rest and see you in the morning. Those of you who want to stay up later and do some more meditation, you can meditate in your rooms if you wish to, or on the stupa over there. There's many other places you can make use of in this compound, and you're most welcome to enjoy the many wonderful little places. Even, I shouldn't really say this, but why not? It's sometimes if you, the stupa, the stones are very warm because they soak up the heat during the night. And sometimes people lay on there and the stupa and just gaze at the stars and the full moon. It's delightful.